Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on 90.1. I'm Lauren Silverman in today for Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about a vaccine for cancer, the HPV vaccine. In the studio with me are Dr. Jasmine Tiro, author of a new study on the delivery of the HPV vaccine in Dallas, and Dr. Jason Turk, a pediatrician at Cook Children's Hospital in Fort Worth. Back in 2007, former Governor Rick Perry issued an executive order mandating all 11 and 12-year-old girls in Texas receive the vaccine. There was immediate backlash, and then sharp criticism when he ran for president 5 years later. This is what Michelle Bachman had to say.
I'm a mom of three children, and to have innocent little 12-year-old girls be forced to have a government injection through an executive order is just flat out wrong. That should never be done. That's a violation of a liberty interest.
Dr. Turk, in your opinion, what role do politicians have in promoting or even, in this case, mandating vaccines?
Well, we'd like to think that they would provide a positive role in supporting public health, because public health is something that we all need to invest in. Unfortunately, more recently, we've seen vaccines and vaccine provision being used as a whipping post to appeal to a political base, which is probably not that interested in supporting public health. Public health is not that exciting a thing. If we do it well, then nobody gets sick and nobody gets hurt. And that's not as sexy as saying that we shouldn't be doing these things without respecting people's liberties.
So Rick Perry later issued this executive order, after issuing the executive order, he went back and he said he shouldn't have done that executive order. He should have let Congress push something through. Was it a mistake to back off?
It depends on what his rationale for backing off was. I think with the benefit of time, we've understood that one of the reasons he put out the executive order was because he had an acquaintance who was dying from cervical cancer, and he had a personal imperative to try and protect more people from the effects of HPV infection. It was not some political, diabolical plan that he had to try and push the vaccine on everybody. He realized that he had stepped in it politically, and so he had to back off. It was a political reality that he needed to retract from where he had been.
Dr. Tiro, do you know which states currently mandate the HPV vaccine?
There are currently three states that I'm aware of that mandate the vaccine. They have opt-out policies, provisions that enable parents to choose not to get their child vaccinated. The states that are covered are Rhode Island, D.C., and Virginia.
And why those states, or how hard was it to get something passed in those states compared to others?
The issue of why states introduce legislation and who's able to pass that legislation is really contextual to that state. It varies. There's sometimes a lot of impetus and push and consensus, and that's what we're looking for in terms of passing policies and making sure that policy makers have the information that's necessary so that they can make an informed decision about whether that policy is in the best interest of their constituents or not.
So let's talk about this vaccine then, because those are some of the facts that you would hope lawmakers are aware of. What is HPV and how does this vaccine work?
Sure. Well, HPV stands for human papillomavirus, and it happens to be one of the most common infections that we see in humans. There are lots of different types of HPV. Some types we are all very familiar with because certain types of HPV cause common warts that you see on your hands and your feet that you might go to the doctor to get frozen off. And then there are other strains of HPV that can cause genital warts. And more seriously, there are certain strains of HPV that are associated with the development of precancerous lesions and then cancer of various places in the body. Probably the most common cancer that we as a society are familiar with that is caused by HPV is cancer of the cervix. And I'm sure that many of our listeners know people who have had cervical cancer and who have been adversely affected by that. But we also know that HPV causes other types of cancers, anogenital cancers. Probably one of the most famous people that died in the last 10 years was Farrah Fawcett. She had anal cancer, and it was a horrible disease for her that she passed from. And then probably one of the least understood but most rapidly rising types of cancers are cancers of the head and neck, oropharyngeal cancers that are associated with human papillomavirus infection. At the MD Anderson Cancer Center, that's one of the fastest rising cancers that they're seeing. And by the end of this decade, the number of HPV-associated head and neck cancers will exceed cervical cancers, which is really quite disturbing. I can tell you that I've talked to victims of HPV-associated oropharyngeal cancers, and it is a horrible disease, incredibly disfiguring to treat as far as surgeries and radiation therapy. It's not a disease that anybody would want to get.
So with the vaccine, and Dr. Tira, I know you're familiar with how it works. It's not a simple one-time shot vaccine as some are.
No, it's a three-dose series.
What's the process?
It's a three-dose series that's administered. The second and third doses are administered 2 months and 6 months after the first dose. And so it's challenging for adolescents to come in and get all three doses in a timely fashion. And that's part of the reason why it's recommended for administration in the 11 to 12-year-old well-child visit. I mean, I think that really the thing to know about HPV infection is that some people clear it. Their immune system is able to fight off that infection, and some don't. And when they don't, they develop a persistent infection, and that infection causes precancerous lesions. Now, we don't know who's able to clear it and who's not. And so that's why we really want all to get the vaccine, so that we can protect everyone.
Yeah, and one thing I would add there is that I have plenty of friends and women who get pap smears, and it comes back positive as showing some concern, check up, follow. But usually the standard is, okay, we'll wait and see what happens. As you say, usually that clears itself. It's when it doesn't that's the problem.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the burden of dealing with abnormal pap smears and having to go under surveillance to see if you resolve that abnormality is scary for women. And it's something that we can prevent them from experiencing if they get the vaccine, all three doses, when we recommend it.
So I was going to just add on I think it's been properly stated that HPV is like the common cold of the genitals. It's that common. We know that 80% of us are going to be exposed to and have an infection with the types of HPV that can cause problems. And it's absolutely correct that the vast majority of those infections will be properly cleared by our own immune systems. We can't know which one of the significant minority of us will go on to have a problem that will create a cancer 2 to 4 decades later.
Now, before Rick Perry dropped his push in Texas for the mandate for HPV vaccination, he befriended a Texas woman that you mentioned, Jason, Heather Burcham, who was dying of cervical cancer. And there was this big awareness campaign that she was a part of. Let's listen to her story a little bit before she died in 2007.
And I went to the doctor and I explained to him all my symptoms, what I was going through, that my mother had cervical cancer, and they all kind of just shushed me and, you know, blew me off because they really believed that someone so young and healthy, there was no way that they could have cancer. I was devastated. It broke my heart. I was angry because I felt like I had told them and, you know, they didn't listen. And I was heartbroken because I knew that so much that I wanted was over, that getting married, having children, it was all over for me.
That was Heather Burcham. She was a Texas woman who was dying in 2007 of cervical cancer, who Governor Perry had befriended. And that video was part of an awareness campaign for the HPV vaccine. It's a rare voice to hear, and of course, this isn't something that everyone who gets HPV will die from. How often is the disease fatal?
So in Texas, we diagnose about 1,000 women every year with cervical cancer, invasive cervical cancer, and about 300, just over 300, die each year. So we have the second highest number of new cases and the second highest number of deaths in our country. So it's a tremendous burden. As long as people are connected to the healthcare system and they, when they have symptoms and they get regularly screened, they seek out care, there are a lot of measures that we can use, procedures that we can do that can help excise that precancerous lesion before it turns into invasive cancer. And so it's really important for people to get screened and get screened regularly.
Now, what role, Jasmine, do public awareness campaigns have?
I think, you know, if you looked at 10 years ago when the vaccine first came out, very few women knew about HPV. Very few women knew that HPV was related to cervical cancer and to other types of cancers. And so we've made tremendous progress in terms of raising awareness. Now, the people who pay attention to this are frequently not parents who have an age-eligible child. Mm-hmm. And so raising awareness for each new cohort of parents as their child becomes eligible for the vaccine is a new challenge. We can't sit and just assume that everyone knows because we're so well-connected from a health perspective. We've got to, you know, stay vigilant, and we've got to continue to educate parents as their children become eligible.
So tell me about your work in Dallas with public awareness of HPV and the study you did.
We've been doing a lot of studies with the Parkland Health and Hospital System, which is our safety net in Dallas. Parkland sees a large number of cervical cancer cases and has a high burden of cervical cancer screening in that population. And so we're really interested in promoting the vaccination in that population. And so we've been doing studies over the past 8 years since I've been here in Dallas. And what we found out is that parents really were unaware and they were unprepared for a discussion when they would meet with their provider. And sometimes they needed more time to be prepared. And so we tested behavioral intervention strategies, educational brochures that are about the HPV vaccine, as well as other strategies such as calls to parents who have declined the vaccine to see if they changed their mind and would like to get the new vaccine, or calls to parents who haven't gotten the second and third doses. And we tested those three strategies through a randomized control trial to see if that worked to get our rates up. And some of them worked.
Some of the strategies did.
Some.
Which ones?
So the educational brochure that was focused on raising awareness about HPV worked for Hispanic parents, but not for African American parents. And that's one of the first studies that has ever shown that there was a difference in terms of how the different race ethnicities were reacting to educational materials. We didn't expect that to happen. The other thing is we found that the reminders, so bringing parents and calling them and saying it's time for your second and third dose, that worked very well, and it worked for all parents.
Really? So for across ethnicities and backgrounds?
Across ethnicities, that works. It's an investment, right? It requires clinics know and providers know who hasn't gotten the second and third doses and invest resources to call them and reach out to them. And so our study shows that investing in that effort pays off for clinics to raise their rates.
Now, we're going to hear Dr. Turk from you a little bit about from the doctor's side of in a moment, but we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman in today for Chris Boyd. This hour, the HPV vaccine, why the rate of vaccination in the U.S. hovers around 30%, which is far below that of other countries. You can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372, by emailing think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet. I'm @LSilverwoman. We'll be back with more from Jason Turk and Jasmine Tiro in just a moment.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. This hour, we're talking about a vaccine for cancer, the HPV vaccine. In the studio with me are Dr. Jasmine Tiro, author of a new study on the delivery of HPV vaccine in Dallas, and Dr. Jason Turk, who's a pediatrician at Cook Children's Hospital in Fort Worth and immediate past president of the Texas Pediatric Society. We were just before the break, Jasmine, talking about the study that you did in Dallas on the effectiveness of public awareness about HPV and getting young girls, and at that point it was just focused on young girls vaccinated for HPV. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the biggest barriers for getting this vaccine.
I think it's making sure that we have that we educate parents about the rationale behind why this vaccine is recommended. And that's what parents are really concerned about. You know, parents are motivated to do what's best for their child, to protect their child. And it's unfortunate that decisions about vaccine have been called more into question because they're one of our greatest public health success stories. And so we have a harder job helping parents make a decision about vaccines than we did, you know, decades ago when everyone had experience with vaccine preventable illnesses. So when it comes to the HPV vaccine, parents are questioning about whether the vaccine prevents, it cures, or it treats HPV infection. They want to know that it's been tested and that before it was approved. They want to know that there are no long-term side effects, that it doesn't affect their development, their fertility, that the vaccine doesn't actually do the opposite of what we think it does. We know that it prevents HPV infection and it doesn't cause cancer. And sometimes they get mixed up in terms of what that means and they'll see other information. And so we want to make sure that they understand why it's urgent that they make that decision now, that they protect their child now before they're exposed to the virus.
Now, that's a good point, Dr. Turk, for you to jump in. Why is it so important to get this vaccine at the age of 11 or 12? Why then?
Well, to be sure, as parents, we don't look at our 11 and 12-year-old children as future sexually active human beings. And that really isn't something that we need to even bring into the conversation, because this is not something that we need to think about as an unavoidable risk. All of us pretty much are going to get infected with or exposed to HPV. So it's a foregone conclusion that there's going to be risk. The reason it's important to get it done at that time is because, like any vaccine, you need to get it in before there's any risk that that you've already been infected. That's the most important reason. And number two, the vaccine actually happens to work best at that age. The older adolescents, when presented with this vaccination, still get a decent immune response, but it's not as robust as that which is seen at 11 and 12 years of age. So that's the reason why it's at that time. There's also some structural parts to how we provide preventive care for children, and 11 to 12 years of age is a designated time when people tend to come to the doctor for their checkups, because they need to get a sport physical, because they need to get other vaccinations that are required to attend school. And so it makes sense logistically and administratively to get this done. There was some mention about how we can do better about reminding people to come back. Well, there are some excellent opportunities out there that people can make use of. One of them is an electronic fridge magnet that we use in my practice, in which we set the fridge magnet to go off at 2 months from the first one and 6 months from the first one. And when it starts blinking, you know, you got to come back and see me to get the second and third parts. If you use these tools, it can dramatically improve completion rates for the vaccine series.
Seems so old school, but I guess, you know, the magnet on the fridge is somewhere in between the cell phone reminder and the slip of paper that your doctor gives you. So did your practice invest in that? Who made that decision?
There are tools that were given to us to help improve rates, and we are very, very pleased to have them. We didn't have to go and have someone contract that job out. This was a tool that was given to us, and it's available to many other practices if they just ask for it.
So I think, you know, the other thing to note is that while ideally it's delivered to in the second doses and third doses are delivered to in 6 months later, it doesn't matter if you do take a little bit longer. And most people here in the United States, most kids, get it about every year. Mm. And that's usually when they're getting their well child visits, right? So if we have to get three doses in, it can usually take about 3 years, 2 years for
and that's okay.
them to finish.
Yeah.
And that's okay. They're still protected.
It's not ideal.
Yeah.
I tell my parents that vaccines are like your mother-in-law. They never forget. You don't have to start the series over if you forgot to come see me when you're supposed to. We just pick it up where we left off.
Now, in the community in North Texas, Jasmine, what did you find about concerns about the vaccine or misconceptions?
The women who we interviewed, and we did extensive formative research in both English and Spanish, is that they really wanted their concerns allayed about side effects, safety concerns. And they really wanted understanding about motivation. And so when you played that quote of the woman who did not survive cervical cancer, experiencing the emotion of regret is very motivating to parents because, you know, you're having to imagine a future where their child would get infected with HPV infection and then where they're trying to fight off a cancer. And so if you can trigger that emotional decision, right, of regret, it can be very motivational. And that's something that we try to convey to them about why they would want to do this and why they don't want to wait, why delaying is not the right choice.
And when patients come, well, parents and patients come to your office, Jason, what do you say? What is the standard speech you give to the kid if they're with their parent, or do you separate them? How does it go down?
Well, I think that kind of leads to one of the important stories about why we are, in fact, failing to provide this vaccination. There are situations in which families are pushing back and have questions and are resisting. But I don't think that tells the entire story. I would say that there's good evidence that we as physicians many times overestimate the amount of resistance that we're likely to face from families. And if we approach the conversation with a sense of ambivalence that it's going to be a bit of a beatdown when I introduce this vaccination, it carries through in not only the content but the manner in which we are talking to our families and our body language and all those sort of subtle things, which will then cripple our ability to properly perform this vaccination. The story of how we are failing to provide this vaccination is one in which physicians are simply not doing the job that we need to do. And it's unprecedented because we've done this job many times before with many other vaccinations exceedingly well. So how do I do it? Well, I tell my families, your child is here for a checkup and your child needs to get the Tdap and the HPV vaccination and the meningococcal vaccination. And those are the three adolescent vaccinations that we need to give. And the HPV vaccination is a three-part series, so I'll need to have your child come back in 2 months and then again in 6 months. And then if you approach it in a very sort of matter-of-fact, presumptive way, then families say, okay, well, that's what we need to do. If you put the HPV vaccination in the special chair and you say, your child needs to get the Tdap and the meningococcal vaccination because their school requirements, and we also have this optional HPV vaccination if you'd like to get it, you're definitely not going to see the same ability to provide this vaccination than you otherwise would, because families will say, well, why would he not recommend this as strongly as the other ones? And that comes through in how we perform on this vaccination.
Do you think doctors, I don't know, in Texas or in general, are as ambivalent or more ambivalent about this than when it first came out? Has that gotten improved?
I wouldn't say so based upon the data, because if you look at the actual numbers from the National Immunization Survey team that is done every year by the CDC, the rates are flat. We're not improving over time. And it's qualitatively and quantitatively vastly different than how we've done with two other vaccinations that came out around the same time, the Tdap and the meningococcal vaccinations. You already mentioned that.
And HPV is a heck of a lot easier to pronounce than that second one you just said.
Yeah, that's true. Well, people are also keyed to be very concerned about meningitis. And they say,
yes,
oh, definitely
yes.
Want to get the meningitis vaccination. And they should. But in reality, the burden of disease from meningococcal infection is a fraction of what we see from HPV. It's not even close. So, you know, when we talk about the rates, we're doing worse in Texas than the national average, and we're doing worse in Texas this year in this year's survey than we did last year. for girls getting a complete series. We are truly at risk of being a generation of physicians that will leave a cohort of adolescents vulnerable to diseases and cancers that we could have prevented. And that's very concerning to me.
So what do you do in the community, Jasmine, when you're out there? What works with – you said some techniques work with some groups of people and some don't in terms of educational brochures. Are there language barriers?
So I don't think the issue is language barriers. I think the issue is about how the information is presented and what information helps parents make a decision. And sometimes different parents need different pieces of information. And that's challenging to do during a clinical visit. And as Dr. Turk was saying, is that, you know, what type of information is necessary varies. And trying to elicit what information is necessary is challenging. And so we've got to do a better job both training providers on their communication skills so that they can better understand what are the specific concerns for that particular parent sitting in that office room. And we have to do a better job preparing parents so that when asked what their concerns are, they can share that clearly. Because a lot of times they're not necessarily being clear or volunteering what their information.
And maybe they just won't return.
Right. And so it's all about that preparation time before they come into that visit. And that's something that we're studying right now, is what can we do to help prepare them? You know, making a decision about a healthcare, learning about that is no different than making a decision about any type of behavior that we're trying to do. And some parents aren't prepared for what we do to train for that. So how can they better, you know, make, for example, a pro and a con list for that decision? What are their concerns? Mm-hmm. And then voice those concerns to their parents. And so we're working on a tablet app right now and studying to see if helping them voice their concerns via a tablet app helps them better engage in a discussion with their provider, and then hopefully make the decision to get the vaccine.
You can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Let's go to the phones now. Jim in Fort Worth.
Hi, good morning. So I was diagnosed with throat cancer 2 years ago. I'm a 46-year-old male. I'm not a smoker. And what they determined was that it was actually the HPV virus that had manifested itself in me as form of throat cancer. Can you talk about vaccinations for young men as well as young women?
Great question. Dr. Turk, do you want to take that one?
This vaccination was initially approved for females only, not because we didn't think it wasn't going to work for males, but because the studies simply had not been done yet. And then subsequently, that data became available and recommendations were made so that now all males and females 11 years of age should get this vaccination for the reasons that the caller just mentioned. He unfortunately has experienced one of the cancers that can arise from HPV infection. And so although the rates for males are lower than they are for females, they should be getting it just as frequently as females are. They don't have a cervix, but they definitely can get HPV-associated cancers. And it's, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, the type of cancer that the gentleman was mentioning is one of the fastest rising cancers that's being seen. It's a very concerning situation.
Because it was recommended only in 2012 for boys, the rates for boys are lagging behind girls. So while we have 34% of girls who've had all three doses in Texas, only 18% of boys have had all three doses. And so our job is harder, and we've got to raise more awareness. Parents are unaware that this vaccine can benefit their male children, and so we've got to raise that awareness. They think that it's only going to benefit their sons' future partners or spouse, but it also has a direct benefit to them. And so there's multiple reasons why parents should opt to get the vaccine for their boy for their sons.
So do you expect to receive, or do you in the office, Jason, receive the same type of questions or concerns from parents of boys or boys themselves as parents of girls or girls themselves?
I really don't. My experience is that if a parent is concerned about the HPV vaccination, it doesn't end up being necessarily for reasons that are gender specific. It's not been my experience that a family or a parent will say, well, why does he need this vaccination? Because he's not going to get cervical cancer. Maybe that's come up once or twice. Usually it's the same kinds of questions that people have about the vaccine in general, which brings up another point. I mentioned before that physicians need to bundle the recommendation with the other vaccinations that people normally get. But as was mentioned before, also, we need to be competent at answering questions and concerns that are raised by families that are valid, and we have to be respectful of that. But we also have to be very competent at answering those questions and taking the time to do so in a respectful fashion. We know, based upon an excellent study done, that if a physician engages a resistant parent who otherwise was not going to get the vaccination, a physician can bring that patient and parent along to get the vaccination 50% of the time. 50% of initial resistors will go ahead and get the vaccine.
So that's a pretty big increase. I mean, your power and generally the power of a doctor and a physician is pretty great.
That is the key. If we provide an affirmative, unequivocal recommendation, this is a needed vaccination. I vaccinated my kids. I wouldn't want your kid to be vulnerable to a cancer later on. That's really valuable. Parents who stated they were not going to get the vaccination for the next 12 months listed a lack of an affirmative recommendation from their physician as one of the highest reasons for not getting it.
And you have children as well, right?
I've got two boys, and they both had the series.
And you remembered when to take them in.
I think I did, yes.
Or do you have the fridge magnet?
No, I didn't need the fridge magnet.
All right. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. This hour, we're talking about the HPV vaccine and why the rate of vaccination in Texas is lower than in the national average. You can join our conversation if you have questions about the vaccine by calling 800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Please give us a ring. We'll be back with more from Dr. Jason Turk and from Jasmine Tiro in just a moment.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. This hour we're talking about cancer and a vaccine that's often misunderstood. The HPV vaccine. In the studio with me, Jasmine Tiro. She's the author of a study on the HPV vaccine and outreach in Dallas. And Jason Turk, he's a pediatrician with Cook Children's Hospital and author of an opinion piece called Epic Fail, Why We Physicians Must Do More to Promote Cancer-Preventing HPV Vaccine. So let's talk a little bit about the cost of the vaccine, both for patients and for larger organizations, hospitals, and networks, Dr. Turk. This isn't a free vaccine, right?
No, not by any means. And it's actually one of the most expensive vaccinations that we routinely give. And depending on your source of where you can buy vaccines for families that are insured by private insurance, the cost of each dose can range anywhere from $130 to $155. So it's very important that people understand how to provide vaccines in a way, people as in physicians, how to provide vaccines in a way that they're not going to lose money. The good news is that the vast majority of insurance plans have provision of HPV vaccination as a covered benefit. And that's one of the things that's part of the Affordable Care Act. There are only a very few grandfathered plans that potentially would not. And even in those situations, if you have an insurance plan that doesn't cover the cost of the HPV vaccination or any other vaccination, the child would be then potentially eligible for state-funded vaccines as an underinsured person. If a child is covered by a state-funded plan such as Medicaid or the Children's Health Insurance Program, the vaccine is a covered benefit and it's free for the provider to get and free for the families to get as well. There really should be very, very, very few situations in which a child who's eligible to get this vaccination could not get it because of cost.
Is that what you see, Jasmine Tiro, in the community? That do people talk about cost as a barrier?
No, we actually find that cost is not the barrier. It's really awareness and and motivation to make the decision to get the vaccine now. And so the Vaccine for Children's Program, which is a federal state partnership to provide access to those who are uninsured, is one of the greatest things program-wise to ensure equal access to all children who are eligible for the vaccine.
Let's go to the phones now. Let's go to Ryan in Dallas. Ryan, are you with us?
Oh, yes, I am. I have a quick question. I'm 26, and I'm a little bit further up on the age scale. I'm assuming I can get tested for HPV, and if it turns out that I am negative, would it still be beneficial to get the vaccine?
Great question, and we hadn't talked about testing, so that's a good point, Dr. Turk.
Unfortunately, there is no good way to test people for active HPV infection. You may be able to get testing to see if you've historically been infected with antibody levels. Really, the only routinely done testing for HPV-associated diseases are the pap smears that women get. As far as the indication, the age indication or the spread of when the HPV vaccination is recommended to be given, it's 11 to 26-year-olds. And so it is, if you're 26 years of age, check your insurance plan. You probably are still able to get it because it's within the age recommendation. And there is no downside to getting the vaccination if you've already been exposed to HPV. There are, in the most commonly used HPV vaccination, there are 9 strains included. And if you've not been infected with all of them, then you're going to get benefit from a good part of the vaccination.
Great. Let's go back to the phones. We've got quite a few calls here. Tasha in Dallas.
Yes. I was calling in because I think the part about awareness and being reminded about going back to get the second and third dosage is really important. I myself was previously, just recently, diagnosed as having HPV. About 6 months ago, I had to have an emergency hysterectomy because I had precancerous cells, and I have 3 daughters, and my 16-year-old, who did receive the vaccination when she went in to have her physical for sports, but of course the doctor didn't even, you know, recommend or remind us about coming back before, after she recommended that we get the shot. And even for my 12-year-old, she never recommended that he obtain the vaccination. It was never even an option or a question in it. And I think that's really important because had I not listened to this segment here, I actually forgot that I need to take my 16-year-old back. And I think that's really important because she would have gone back until she got ready to get her sports physical on August of 2016. So I think that's really, really important that the doctors remind them. And, you know, also with giving the option, because I was given the option, even though I told the doctor, hey, I have HPV, I have to have an emergency surgery in a few months, she still said, well, if you want to do it for your daughter, you know, just think about it. And I went ahead and did it because I understood what was going on with myself personally.
Now, quick question before you go. Did you talk to your daughters about what this vaccine is about? Did you try and bring up the idea of cancer and sexually transmitted diseases? Or did you just say, you need this vaccine, this is what you're going to get?
I actually did talk to them right there at the appointment, only because the doctor, you know, said, well, if you want to get this vaccination for your daughter, you can. And I stopped right there and I said, look, this is why you need to get it. This is what's going on with mom. Because they knew that I had been sick for a while. And I explained to them, this is what's going on with mom. This is what happened. You know, different ways that you can contract it. And we actually had that conversation there at the doctor's office. And then I went ahead and let her be vaccinated for it.
All right. Thank you so much for your call. Do you hear a lot about that, Jasmine Tiro or Dr. Turk, about doctors just nonchalantly sort of passing over the recommendation?
Yeah, this is termed a participatory approach to this vaccination versus a presumptive approach. And I think it's important to tell people why they're getting the vaccination in a way that makes sense without having diarrhea of the mouth. you should say this is a vaccination that protects against an extremely common infection that causes cancer, and that's why we need to give this vaccination. The participatory approach that was that was described by the caller is exactly the kind of approach that results in underperformance in giving this vaccination. I look at any opportunity that we did not give the vaccination as a failure, because we never know when we're going to see that patient again. And so you have to get the job done when the opportunity presents itself. Otherwise, 20, 30 years down the road, you could be dealing with a cancer that you could have prevented. I was in the room once when a woman stood up and said, if this vaccination had been available when I was young, then I could have been a mother. But I can't be a mother now because I've had so many surgeries on my cervix. It breaks your heart.
I'm so glad that your caller was listening. And I mean, it just speaks to the power of radio shows like this that raise awareness. You know, just because your doctor hasn't reminded you doesn't mean that you can't empower yourself and remind yourself. I'm a parent. I have a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old, and I am busy. I'm really busy. And it's really challenging to get everything taken care of for school, for health, for doctor's visits, et cetera. The thing to note is that you can always schedule a nurse-only immunization appointment. You don't have to wait for the next visit. You can call up your doctor and say, I know my child is due. Can I schedule her for an appointment? And they're going to make the time because they want to do the best thing for your child.
You don't even have to see the physician.
You don't have to see the physician. You can go in and just get the immunization. And it's dropping by and doing that. It's making the time and realizing that it's important and helping set those reminders, because reminders, they really are helpful.
And kudos to the caller for being an effective advocate. That's fantastic.
Let's go back to Fort Worth to Mark there with a question.
Hi there. Thanks for the show today. And thank you for that piece of advice you just gave about the nurse-only visit. I've never heard that before, and that's a great tip to know, because so often we do just wait on the doctor. My question is this. I have two teenage daughters, both of whom have genetically predisposed epilepsy, and they're on medications for that. Are there any contraindications to taking the HPV virus vaccination, rather?
No, there are no contraindications like a condition such as epilepsy to getting the HPV vaccination. There are no contraindications for underlying conditions that I'm aware of at all for the HPV vaccination. It is like any other vaccination, a vaccination that presents a part of the virus, a protein that can stimulate immune response, so that if the person is subsequently exposed, the immune system will recognize it and prevent an actual infection. As a matter of practice and as a best practice, it is a very good idea, once the first vaccine has been given, to go ahead at the time that you're checking out at the physician's office to schedule that next appointment, which should be a nurse visit. And that way it's already on the calendar, already on the schedule, and just get the job done.
We have a few emails here from Darla and from Holly. And one thing they have in common is they're asking for people who are adults already, maybe in their 30s, 40s, so on, whether they learn they have the virus or not. Does it make sense to get a vaccine that late?
Well, the short answer to that question is we don't really know, because the vaccine has been studied in the age group for which it is currently recommended. The older you are, because this is so common, an infection, the older you are, the more likely it is that you've been exposed, and the less effective the vaccine might be. But as I mentioned before, the most commonly used vaccination has 9 strains in it, and it's an open question and probably going to be an area of active research going forward about whether it's appropriate for older people to get the vaccination if they've already had sex in their lives.
The vaccine is approved for administration in older ages in other countries.
Oh, really?
The Cervarix vaccine specifically. And so while you might not receive the full benefit because you may have been exposed to one or more strains, exposure, you might not have been exposed to all the 9 strains that are covered in the vaccine. So, you know, there is no reason why you can't get the vaccine. Now, whether your insurance plan will pay for that vaccine because you are in the older age range, that is a question that you have to ask your insurance plan. But if you if they do pay for it, then that's great. And if they don't pay for it and you're willing to pay those out-of-pocket costs, then, again, you may benefit from it. Our goal nationally is to make sure that we administer it in the younger age range. But, you know, in this in-between stage where there's a lot of people out there who might still benefit, it's a decision that you have to make for yourself.
Now, what do we know, Jasmine Tiro, about comparisons between Texas and other states? Or what can we learn from efforts in other states, or you just mentioned other countries, about effective ways to get information out about HPV?
You know, I think, you know, it's very challenging to deliver the vaccine here in the United States because we do it opportunistically. And what we mean by opportunistically is that it requires the chance that you come into a clinic and meet with your doctor and the doctor recommends it. In a lot of other countries that have higher rates, they have rates of over 70%, over 80% in Australia.
Wow. And here it's more like 30%.
30% for all three doses, okay?
Yeah.
So we are lagging far behind. So if we want to be competitive about other countries, this is a reason why we should, you know, increase our vaccination rates. They have higher rates because they have an organized program to deliver it systematically. So they systematically invite all children ages 11 to 12. They send that invitation through the schools to notify them that they're that's an option. And that it's a recommended option by the government to get the vaccine. That systematic invitation ensures that everyone is aware about it, right? So we don't have to depend on a chance encounter between you and your doctor. Now, if you see your doctor regularly, and most adolescents do, not frequently, but they do see him regularly, then you'll likely get that recommendation. But if we set regular reminders, you know, if we set a systematic invitation to everyone, we could probably boost our rates up. Because it's not that parents don't, you know, want to do something that protects their child against cancer. It's that they're not aware that they have that option, and that option, it's now is the time to do it.
As we wrap up, Dr. Tark, tell me any last words of encouragement for doctors or just advice?
Well, I think that one of the key issues with respect to better performing countries is that they have a much more integrative healthcare system, and the culture supports that. In those countries, they've already had some short-term gains. For example, in Australia, the rates of genital warts associated with HPV have plummeted. The rates of precancerous cervical lesions are going down dramatically. The potential that is unrealized in this country is enormous with this vaccination. We have to do better. And I guess my final thought is we physicians in this country, in our culture, are the ones that have to lead the charge and be champions. So far, we've not done a good job, and we have to learn how to do a better job. It's our job. We have to do this for our children now so they can be healthy and not disease-bearing people later on.
Jason Turk is a pediatrician at Cook Children's Hospital in Fort Worth, and Jasmine Tiro is an associate professor at UT Southwestern who has done extensive research on HPV prevention and awareness. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. And you can contact us via email think@kera.org. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.